Howdy, y'all. Welcome to Components. I'm Ren, product marketer at Heretto and your podcast MC.
I'm Patrick, CEO here at Heretto.
And I'm Jared, lead solutions consultant.
Thanks for joining us on our weekly conversation about componentized and structured content. Hope you enjoy this 15 or so minutes of fun talking about everything from data to innovations in AI.
All right, let's get into it.
Hi, welcome to Components. I'm here today with Sarah O'Keefe, CEO and founder of Scriptorium. Scriptorium is an industry-leading consultancy in the enterprise content strategy and content operations space. Welcome, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about what you've been up to and specifically about the work that we did together on the content operations book.
Yeah, that was a fun project that went on for a long time, and now it's finally out there in the world, and it is great.
Yeah, very excited. It took a little longer than we expected, but I guess all good things tend to go that direction. So before we get started, I gave a little bit of an intro and bio on you here, but I'd love to get a little bit more background from you on who you are and how you're related to the space.
So as you said, I run a company called Scriptorium, which is interested in the question of how you apply technology to publishing problems. Our bread and butter is organizations that have problems with their technical and product and learning content and are trying to figure out how to deliver that content, develop, deploy, and deliver that content to their customers as efficiently as possible and as well as possible, taking into account customer experience and all the rest of it. In practice, that looks an awful lot like we have 8 different content systems and we need to share content across them and we can't. We have 4 languages that we're translating into today, but we've been told to add 27 more and our process will not scale. What do we do?
Yeah, that makes sense. And that reflects what I think I've seen a lot with your group and the projects that we've worked on together. Mm-hmm. So before we talk specifically about your chapter, you know, can you just tell me a little bit of the story about how you got involved with the content operations book project and, you know, where it started from your perspective?
Well, we have to give all the credit to Dr. Carlos Avia at Virginia Tech, who is really the person that made this happen. Carlos and I go a ways back, as you do as well. Sure. And he is one of the few people in academia who is interested in really connecting the academics who are doing research on rhetoric and tech comm and, you know, those kinds of things with the practitioners in the industry. So Carlos has used over the years some of the books that we've produced around technical writing and content strategy, and he was looking at those and asking about whether he could make updates, whether we could do another edition, bring that into, you know, the 2020s, I guess. And what came out of that, instead of an update to our tech writing book or our content strategy 101 book, what came out of that was a much bigger project with involvement from all sorts of people, including you and about a dozen other, you know, really interesting authors, that resulted in this content operations book being created.
Yeah. And thinking back to the early days of this, I think it was it just the 3 of us right out of the gate? So it was Carlos and it was you, and then it was me. I think I was third in, right? Is that right?
And then Rahel got involved. Rahel and Bailey got involved pretty early. Okay, and then, yeah, I mean, my memory, you know, I want to be careful because I'm afraid we'll leave somebody out that was involved early on. But yeah, definitely it started with a small core group and then it sort of expanded into discussions of personalization and localization and governance. And we brought in, or Carlos brought in, people from those areas that are experts in those specific aspects of content ops.
Yeah. So it's very interesting because you think about it, and the real beginning of this was, you know, Carlos going out and deciding that we needed to update academia on what's going on in industry. And he basically immediately went out and got you.
I mean, yeah, that's more or less what happened. I mean, I think that when you look at students, undergrads, or, you know, less so grad students, but when you look at undergrads that are getting educated in the tech comm space, they need to come out of that with you know, solid preparation to actually go into the world and to take on some of these jobs. Now, the tension here, and this is, you know, really Carlos is the expert on this, but the tension here is between giving them a solid foundation in the concepts and going into what, you know, in academia they call too vocational, you know, too hands-on, too many tools. They don't want to teach you a specific version of a specific tool because by the time you're done with school, it's potentially obsolete. What they want to teach you is not so much here's how to use help authoring tool X, but rather this is what a help authoring tool is, and this is why they exist, and this is the context in which you would apply them.
Yeah.
And so he, in his curricula, he's trying to straddle that divide between, you know, practical and applicable as you go into the world and you get a job, probably not in academia, versus what is the underlying foundation of what it means to be in TechCom, and, you know, what is TechCom and why do you care?
Yeah, I definitely noticed that tension pretty early on in the development of the book, where it was clear that there was this need to really get into systems, because content operations in a lot of ways is a practice of systems. But there was a desire to stay away from extreme specifics on those systems, which is a funny balance to try to strike when you're really, like, you're dealing with technology, right? So it's like, don't go too deeply into the technology or specific technologies, but we need to know a lot about the technologies and the rationale around those technologies. And I think we did a pretty good job of that, you know, looking at the content of the book. It'll be interesting to see what the wider world thinks of that.
Yeah, it's one thing to say these three organizations should all be working together and should all be producing content that is consistent and unified and looks related to the end customer, right? Because the end customer goes to the organization's website and they consume content there. They're trying to figure out, how do I do a thing, right? Ultimately, technical content is enabling content. It enables you to use the product successfully. And I really wish I'd written that, but that was actually Tim O'Reilly way back when. Okay, so TechCom and learning content and knowledge base and all these other customer facing, you know, product content things are enabling content. However, as a customer, I'm on the website and I'm looking for the answer to my question, and my user experience in the knowledge base versus the learning content versus the product content is almost certainly going to be different because they're not unified. And as a customer, this annoys me because you're using different terminology and I'm confused. I'm already confused, right? I'm confused and angry because I can't use your product and I'm looking up information. So my mindset is already annoyed, and I'm going to get more annoyed if I can't find it. But that's the practical application. When you step back and look at the theoretical, you want to say things like, all of this content should be unified and should be built in a single unified space with enterprise taxonomy and enterprise terminology and enterprise everything else. And then you take a step back from that and say, great, how are we going to do that with the tools that exist in today's world? And the answer is that I'm not allowed to curse on this podcast. So here we are, right? So you bump up, as you say, this should be unified and aligned and et cetera. And then instantly you bump up against, actually it can't be done. Or at least not automatically and not efficiently and not without a lot of work across all of these tools.
Yeah, it's a major undertaking. And I think that in a lot of ways, some of the technology providers have oversold what can be done, or maybe they've oversold what can be done without a lot of effort, because it's still it's a practice. You know, it's a practice that requires professionals who know exactly what they're doing and are willing to put in a lot of effort, which I think is actually a really good dovetail into why it is that you would spend the time and money with those professionals to accomplish this, which is your chapter, right? So, you know, just give us the real brief overview on the chapter you contributed to the book.
I wrote about the business case for content operations. So my job was to explain exactly that. Why would you do this to yourself? right? Or why would your organization go through this extremely painful process that's probably going to involve consultants and new technology and transformation and all these, you know, kind of difficult and challenging things. And ultimately, what I landed on is that there's a couple of different, you know, business strategy breakdowns, and, you know, there's five-step pyramids and all the rest of it. But ultimately, I landed on four major things. The first one, which if you have it, is the deal breaker, is actually compliance, right? If you're in a regulated industry and you are required to deliver content in a certain way that conforms to certain regulatory bodies, and those regulatory bodies are potentially different by region. So there's a regulator in Europe and a different one in the US and a different one in Japan, and you're selling in all of those markets. You have to conform to their requirements, because if you do not, they will do things like tell you you can't sell your product, which is a problem. So compliance is sort of a binary, you either have it or you don't. And if you do, it is essentially your top priority, because if you don't have compliant content and products, you can't sell. You're out of the market. Now, related to that, but a little bit of a softer requirement, is risk management. There's a pretty significant aspect of risk management that goes with your content. If you have a machine, if your product is a machine that can hurt people if used incorrectly, then you have exposure if your content doesn't explain to people. I mean, first, you want to design the machine to be as safe as possible. Second, you want to mitigate the risk. And one of the ways that you can do that is to deliver really good content that explains, don't stick your hand in there. This is a bad idea. You know, bad things will happen. And I mean, we laugh about it, but these are, you know, legitimate risks within the context of, you know, industry and factories and all the rest of it. So risk management and compliance are kind of one piece of this puzzle. I'll also say that for many U.S. companies, when they're talking about risk management, they are really talking about, if somebody does something incorrect or dumb or ridiculous with our machine and they hurt themselves, they are going to sue us. How do we mitigate that risk of a lawsuit and, you know, damages and product liability? The calculations are different in Europe because of the way the regulatory and legal systems work. Right. So risk management and compliance is one. The other three are consistency. You do not want document A or page A on your website to contradict page B on your website and have two different versions of how this works. And we have a fantastic example of this in the news right now, which is this Air Canada chatbot, right? Which said our bereavement policy is X, which it 100% was not, except the chatbot says it was. And Air Canada said, well, really, you should have looked at this webpage over here, which says something different, which is the actual policy. But like, how am I supposed to know that A is more valid than B? And they did, in fact, lose, although they only had to pay it was $500. It was a silly amount. That was very, so consistency.
Article than it did to pay the fine back.
Yeah, I think he went to small claims, so you know. But consistency has real costs. That's a fun example that everybody understands. But this happens all the time, where an older document and a newer document contradict each other. One of them was updated, one of them wasn't, and because they're in two separate silos, they are not connected. They're not consistent. You run into problems. Velocity is a big issue for content ops. And by velocity, what I basically mean is, how fast can you produce the content? How fast can you update the content? How fast can you publish it, distribute it, and all the rest of it? Most of what we do is digital. So publishing is not a thing anymore, right? We don't send it to the printer and have the printer run books, and we do blue lines and we go for a press check, and then they print all the books and put them on a truck and ship them to your office, and then you have to ship them out. That is not a thing. I mean, it happens, but it's not that common. So distribution in a digital world is instantaneous, but the process of getting to the point where you're ready to push that button that says release this, publish this, can take a significant amount of time. And time to market is a problem, right? If I have to wait 6 months for the docs to be translated, then I can't ship into those countries that require in-country, in a local language. So I'm not getting revenue. Right. But also just the velocity of change. If you're in a SaaS environment and your product is software and you're updating it every day or week or month in various sprints, you need the content to keep up. And many of the content workflows are, you know, 100% incapable of keeping up with that velocity. So how do you match the velocity of your content production to the velocity of your product? Totally. And finally, scalability, related to all of these things, but scalability is about, okay, we used to have one product and then we made like three variants, like a light and a freemium and a professional and an enterprise. And that's actually four. And then we're shipping it to various countries and we are doing HR software, which means we have regional variants. So like our content in Canada is different because Canadian HR rules are different from US HR rules. And oh, wait, we need it in French, but oh, wait, that French won't work in France. It'll work in Quebec, but not in France. And so you get into these regional variants that are regulatory, right? In this example, because we have to talk about what it looks like to do payroll in Canada and what pensions look like. They have pensions there. Pensions are cool. Yeah. And then, yeah. And then I think, and then in the US, you have a totally different set of sort of, I mean, generalized, there's how do you hire somebody and how do you fire somebody, but the specifics of what you do and how you do that and how you bring them in are all different. And of course, we have 50 states that are all different. So that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And that's before we get into the question of, oh, wait, I need this for the European market or something like that.
Right.
So scalability is about how do we produce all these different variants for all these different requirements, whether it's regions or product variants or regulatory issues at scale in a way that is efficient and manageable and allows us to take advantage of the overlap, where we only have to describe a particular concept one time. So my HR example is going to break down really fast because it's actually very much regional, right? But when you say to somebody, you get paid time off, that means you don't have to show up at work. And that means you get paid for that day anyway. And in the US, here's your list of federal holidays that we pay, right? Okay, great. But in Canada, the list is different.
Yeah.
And so maybe that intro bit that says you get paid is the same, but the list of holidays needs to be different by region. And it becomes unmanageable almost instantly if, bottom line, you're copying and pasting.
Right.
Copy and paste is bad and it doesn't scale.
Yeah, I mean, like on the scalability aspect, it's, I like to just think of this as giving you leverage with your content production. You know, you can lift more is what it comes right down to with the same number of resources. It's interesting that you actually went in reverse order to the way that you that you did it in your chapter. So, you know, do you think of them in that order, or is the order not that important as you're evaluating the necessity or the business case for content operations for an organization?
I think probably starting with risk management and compliance makes sense. Compliance you either have or you don't. If you're a pharmaceutical company, you have compliance issues. If you make video games, you probably don't. Although I'll note that many video games have a warning at the very, very beginning about lights and seizures, right?
Also the maturity of the content.
And that I think is voluntary, but I'm not sure. Is it? I don't know. They run it through. But yeah, so there's some minimal compliance issues on the video game side of things. There is certainly risk management in the sense of, how graphic do I want this content to be? Do I want this to be a 17 and over or 18 and over kind of game? Or do I want to sell to the teen market? And, you know, what can I get away with? Similar things apply to movies and other, you know, kinds of entertainment content. But I think ultimately we usually start with risk management and what it means to get the content wrong. What happens to you if your content is wrong?
Yeah.
And in the case of most, not all, but most video games, the answer is not a whole lot. I mean, maybe your game doesn't sell, but you know, you're probably not getting shut down by the government. You might get shut down by your reviewers saying your stuff is terrible. But I sort of like to start there. From there, nearly always the next issue is actually scalability.
Interesting. So you kind of, you started with risk management, which is was the last one on your list in your chapter. Mm-hmm. And you kind of rule that in or out. And do you do that because if it's in, the other ones are such a distant second that they're handled later? They're almost nice to haves.
It's kind of, nearly everybody has scalability, velocity, and consistency issues. Not everybody has compliance issues. That's why I kind of put it at the end. If you do, it's your top priority. If you don't, you get to that section of the chapter and you're like, oh, I don't care. And you stop reading. So I didn't want them to see it first and stop reading. Right.
It's interesting. So the one thing that isn't on your list here that I'm curious about is you didn't say anything about just raw capability. So you think about organizations that are coming from, even if they have digital systems, they have a number of digital systems which are inconsistent and not interoperable, and they're trying to deliver that into maybe a single experience, maybe into a product, maybe into a new application, you know, whatever it might be, and they very physically can't. So they lack a capability. Do you feel like that falls under one of the ways that you think about this, or is that actually a fifth justification?
I think that ultimately it falls under scalability and velocity, because if you throw enough bodies at the problem, you can do it, right? You copy and paste, you take a screenshot and you move it over there. I mean, you can do some horrific things,
but
if it's digital content, you can do it. But you can do it badly or you can do it well.
Yeah. my favorite terminology for this is sneaker net.
Uh-huh.
Which I mean, to me is never really been a part of my actual career, but what a sneaker net is for those of us who are too young for floppies is that it was pre-internet. Sneaker net was when you handed someone a floppy disk and they walked it across, you know, the campus someplace else to transfer data. And I just think that that's a funny visual whenever you think about manual labor to move information from one place to another.
And these days we sort of take high speed internet for granted, but there are a couple of places where you still see sneaker net. One is if you have a system that's air gapped. So yes. If it is cut off from the internet for security reasons and you need to get new content into that cutoff system, that is going to involve you hauling, okay, probably a USB drive and not a floppy, but, you know, same difference.
Right.
There was a great study a while back where they looked at internet speeds in various places. This was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. And they found a particular pipe. There was a bottleneck, and I think this was South Africa, but I'm not sure. And what they figured out was that sneaker net was not going to be the most efficient thing, but in fact, they looked at pigeon net, where you take a USB drive.
I was wondering if you were going this direction.
Yep.
And you split of all networks.
You put it on the pigeon, like on a little, a foot thing. Yeah. And it's a homing pigeon, right? So it flies back to wherever it's going and delivers the USB drive, which you then plug in. And they found that that was, in fact, faster than trying to deliver these big files over the constrained internet at the time. So, sneaker net is not quite dead, but it's getting there. And there are a few use cases. We used to talk about airplane help, but of course, now for better or worse, we have Wi-Fi on airplanes.
Right. And I am so happy about that, because the number of times that we had customers say, well, what if I want to work in an airplane? And then they say, well, when was the last time you actually worked in an airplane? I said, well, but what if I want to? It's like, okay.
I have very mixed feelings about Wi-Fi on airplanes. I'm still not over it. You know, the fact that you're sitting up there and there's Wi-Fi, I will never get over that. But on the other hand, I'm sitting in my seat and I am connected to people and I can't just go watch a movie.
Yeah, I just pretend that I don't have it. So I can read a book or watch a movie.
Good strategy. I like it.
So anyways, actually getting back to your chapter and the content in this, you know, I think the business case is really is an interesting aspect of this for me, because it's something that has always felt not squishy, but so individual that it's hard to generalize, even inside of like this framework. Because, and I think you kind of point this out in your chapter where you talk about, well, if you're a scrappy startup versus a Fortune 500, and then you listen to the language that you used around, well, if you have this, or if you have this, then you need this. And like, there's a lot of like if-thens in the business case for this. So in a world where this gets so complicated so quickly, you know, how do you think that somebody who's really just stepping into this, who's just picking up this content operations book, should step back and think about like, okay, when should I start thinking about a business case for content operations? Like, what should be the moment where I'm like, okay, now I need to go understand the business value of this, and I need to start thinking about the business case, not the implementation.
Part of the squishiness is that some of the time when we talk about content operations, what we really mean is, you know, efficient, scalable, timely, consistent, compliant operations. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, content operations itself is just how are you doing the work? So I write a bunch of stuff in Word files and I hand carry them over to this other place and put them on this other server and reformat them and copy and paste. And then we send them for translation via like FTP. That's content ops. It's maybe not efficient, but it is, you know, your operational environment for your content. So all content has an operational environment, has a life cycle. It may or may not be a good one. You may not have any governance or control over what you're doing, but you have an as-is state of how this content gets created. And you can look at content maturity, like are you at level one chaos or have you, you know, completely optimized everything? But ultimately, you have something in place. The question that you ask when we say, let's make a business case for content ops, what we're really saying is, do you have a business case to change and improve what you're doing now? And the answer to that boils down to what are the things that you're trying to do? Can you do them well enough in your current environment? If not, what do you need to change? And is that change and the cost of that change with all that it entails in terms of new systems and, you know, retooling and retraining and all the rest of it, is that change worth the cost? So, or worth the investment, if you want to look at it that way. And that's really the question. It's how, you know, what is your business environment broadly? Mm-hmm. And what is the content operations approach that matches that business? And what's really interesting about this is, you know, we talk about startups. Well, if you have one writer or three writers and they're just kind of doing their thing and they're inefficient, it doesn't really matter because they're small and they can do what needs to be done. But then the company with the three writers acquires another company with five writers and another company with five more and a couple more. And all of a sudden you have 20 writers in like six different content systems, and they're trying to unify all the products into a single environment. And the content is sitting in, you know, five different content systems. And now you actually have critical mass at 20. I mean, maybe less than 20, but 20 people clearly is critical mass for some sort of a really solid content operations environment. And, you know, that's where, you know, the Heretto and the other products in that class, where you start talking about, we need to manage this content, we need to componentize it, it needs to be topic-based so that we can reuse it and move it around and do things with it and connect it to all these other systems that, you know, where it needs to go, which simply is not going to happen in an unstructured, unmanaged, you know, desktop tool.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Everybody has ad hoc content operations. Mm-hmm. Because everybody produces content. So the business case is really about, when do we need to move to a formalized, more mature content operations process? You know, what are the triggers for that? And I think the acquisition, you know, or maybe just growth is one of the best answers to it. So
globalization is the other one.
Yeah, well, I mean, and localization, I guess, broadly could be classified under growth, but maybe that's getting a little distinction without a difference there. So then this kind of naturally leads me to the, you know, one of my last questions was, which is, if you're sitting inside of an organization, how far out into the future do you think you should be looking when you're trying to build a business case?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. Because how far into the future is the business itself looking? Are they living quarter by quarter, or do they have like a 5-year plan or something in between? One of the things that we look at is when, and you know, most of the work that we do has to do with bringing people into a more mature operation, nearly always around structured content. Right. That's that sort of transition or inflection point from unstructured to structured is where we live for the most part. When you reach that point and you start looking at your options, you do not want to be in a position where you're looking at what you're doing and what you're building and saying, well, this will hold us for 12 months. Right. Because by the time you make whatever the transition is, and I don't care what it is, you know, 3 months at least go by, probably more like 6. And then you have a 6-month runway. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh. And it, to give you some examples of this from way back when, a long time ago, I was inside an organization doing some consulting, and they had like literally like FrameMaker 7. This is a long time ago. It did what it needed to do for them. Unstructured, everything was great. They really wanted FrameMaker 8. Like the tech writers in this organization were like, well, we just want to move up to FrameMaker 8. And so we looked at it and it was fine, except that they had been told that there was a non-zero chance that they needed to deliver content in Arabic. And FrameMaker 8 would not do Arabic, a right-to-left language.
Yeah.
It just would not. And so we were faced with this idea that either we would put them, you know, move them up into FrameMaker 8 and update their templates and do a few other things, knowing that we needed a different workflow for Arabic because it would not do it. There were people, apparently there are people that did this with custom fonts and mirrors, but I just, no. Yeah. So do we put you in FrameMaker 8 knowing that it won't deliver on Arabic and we're going to have to do that some other way? Or do we say, you know what, you're going to have to switch systems because you have a language requirement that you cannot meet in this system? So how do you address that divergence? And really the point of this story is that if you are looking at making an investment as a leader, you know, you're the tech comm director or manager or VP or the person with responsibility for product content. If you're looking at making an investment in content ops and you're looking downstream and you know what the requirements are that are probably coming in 12 to 18 months to 2 years, you have to build a system that meets those requirements. You cannot say, I don't want to do it. I'm not ready. I mean, you can stay with what you have and kick the can down the road and postpone your investment maybe, but you cannot go and ask for money to put in a new system that will not address known future requirements. That is a path to a short career at that company.
Yeah, so I mean, you can, and I think we've both seen organizations do that. You should.
Right, but you're not gonna catch me telling them to do it.
Right.
I'm gonna say, this is bad. It's one thing to say our current system can't do X. It right. is entirely another system thing to say, I need some money. And oh, by the way, we still can't do X.
Right. And so I think this kind of gets to the heart of like the, you know, how far into the future do you look? And this is one of the things that was a little bit of a struggle for me when I was writing my chapter in this book, because I recognize I have a bias. Like there's no doubt about that in terms of like how I think about these systems and how I think about standing them up and running them over the long haul. But at the same time, I think that there's good evidence that when you look at these systems, they get things thrown at them down the line and not that far down the line that they don't expect, right? Like it's very uncommon that you install a content operation system and that system does the things that you expected it to do when you built it. And that's it, right? Like it's like those days of like PDF and print are gone where like, we know our outputs are going to look like this. They'll look like this in 3 or 5 years. Like that's just not the world that we live in anymore because the content goes into products. It goes into different devices. Web interactions change constantly. Like the ways that we interact with these things change. So like when I think about this question, I just don't think that any formalized implementation that's not built on structured content is a wise approach. Because even though structured content comes with overhead and it comes with, in a lot of cases, higher upfront investment, the thing that it has that has been proven time and time again is that it will work down the line. Like almost without fail, yes, sometimes you have to build things onto it or ahead of it in the publishing process, but it will always work. So for me, that's kind of the big thing about looking out into the future, other than like the really practical things that you know you're going to have to tackle and like the, not the near term, but kind of the medium term.
We like to talk about unknown future requirements. Mm-hmm. When the Kindle rolled out and it had this new format, which is EPUB adjacent, sort of, yeah. But not exactly. You know, suddenly, oh, we have to find a way to deliver this content for Kindle. How do we do that? There is value, and you know, this goes to your capability question. And you know, I'm not going to die on the hill of whether or not capability is a separate thing. But I would kind of bucket it into scalability and velocity again. So it's the same kind of thing. A new requirement comes along. We have more languages. They have complex glyphs. Can your system handle that? We've decided to, a lot of this is about downstream outputs or publishing pipelines or delivery endpoints. Can we connect to this system over here? And where system over here is an unknown future system, not yet specified, right? I have literally gone into organizations where they said, we're rolling out a new web CMS. Okay, great. What is it? We don't know yet. Okay. Yeah. Well, so you have to, your content has to go to the unknown future web CMS. Okay, great. So our best shot at that is to have a system that has maximum flexibility in terms of what kinds of things it can output and what kinds of options it offers to connect, reach in, grab the content, or push the content. You know, how can I connect this system to other systems?
Yeah.
That's one of the risks you run into is that ultimately, when you look at some of the, and it's not really structured versus unstructured content per se, it's more framework systems and software that allow you to extend and connect versus what I would describe as a more closed system that is difficult to extend. If the closed system gives you what you need today, it has all the publication endpoints that you need, and it connects over to the thing that you need, and it does all the stuff that you need on the inside in terms of authoring and whatever else, then it meets your needs in the moment today. And it's probably going to be cheaper to build it out because it's all in there. Like if your needs are inside the box that they give you, then hooray. The problem that you run into is, what if you have to get outside the box, right? What if you have a new requirement that takes you outside of what that system, what that vendor is giving you, and how are you going to do that? And at that point, you're faced with either we do it the hard way by hand, we do a bunch of configuration work, we do a bunch of custom integration work. I mean, you have some options, but they may not be great. And so I'm mostly agreeing with you, but I would say that this is less a question around is the content structured, and that's part of it. But additionally, the system that you're stashing this content in or that you're managing this content with, how easy is it to extend that and connect it to other things, especially other things not yet identified?
That's a really, really important and valid point. It's so like, even if you're using a component content management system that is, you know, based on or built on Ditta, but you can't get stuff in and out of it in an interoperable way, it's like there's no point in having an open standard locked in a closed system.
And well, again, if the closed system meets all your requirements, then great, onward.
Right, but like you never know what your future requirement's going to be. And that's the risk that you run.
So then you're back to the speed of change inside that organization. So the company that buys the system has to look at, what is our corporate culture? How fast do we change? What do our life cycles look like? I'm going to say stodgier, which sounds a little judgy, right? But the slower and stodgier they are, which is probably related to their regulatory environment and their product types, the more likely it is that they have a, you know, 5 or 10 year runway for new requirements instead of a next week runway. Faster they are. I mean, again, you know, video games are such a great example of this because they have to localize usually, and they have to localize well, because if it sounds clunky, people are like, this isn't fun. I'm not playing this game. Your French is crud. Mm-hmm. Another device comes along, right? Like a phone or a tablet or a screen or a bigger screen or, this week it's VR goggles. Great. And you have to deliver your game.
Technically.
Yeah. You have to deliver your game into that new system. And can you do it? And how? If I'm in video games, I'm extremely interested in making sure that I can go fast, break things, and get it from point A to point B to point C to point like Omega Outer Planet, because that's what's going to happen. If I'm producing, mining equipment that's air gapped, then I'm slightly less interested because my runway for actually creating new mining, trucks, machines, things, is years. Right? You don't just like flip a switch and roll a new one off the line, unlike video games and software generally.
That's fair. I think that definitely the velocity of the underlying business is a mm-hmm. is a fundamental consideration. I don't think I'm going to dive too deeply into a philosophical argument as to whether or not that should change your an open system versus a closed system.
Yeah, I'm just saying if it matches you have to match to your business requirements. And you're arguing that there's always going to be an unknown requirement that's going to blow up your closed system. And I'm not really disagreeing.
I'm fully arguing that, yes.
Yeah, I'm sort of like, yep, seen that. And then sometimes the closed system wins for other reasons.
That's true.
Having to do with risk and implementation and some other things.
Or just raw features. Like there's no doubt that, you know, there's certain closed systems that have really compelling features. So I think that's going to have to be where we leave it on this very lovely conversation, which I'm going to assume has been turned into multiple podcasts. But if it is just one, I'm sure it's a very dense and amazing podcast that we can be proud of. So thank you so much for being here, Sarah. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And thanks for, you know, being my co-author.
Yeah, well, thanks for working on this for years and years and years. And I would like to close again by thanking Carlos for all the work that he did, because without him this thing would not have actually happened. So thank you, Carlos.
That is very, very true and a really good point to end on. Big thank you to Carlos, and thank you everybody for joining us and listening to Components. Hope you'll join us again in the future. We'll be posting all of the authors from each of the chapters, a conversation with each one of them, having a little bit to describe what it is that brought them into the book and how they're thinking about it. So stay tuned, and we'll have more coming your way soon. Thanks. Bye.